From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, we hear from a man who suffered a bite from a black widow spider without painkillers to test a new medicine.
I felt this warmth in my abdomen, and the warmth turned into a tightness. And then the tightness turned into pain, and it was like being punched in the stomach.
Comedian Patton Oswalt shares his obsession with a book about obsession.
The novel Moby Dick is my Moby Dick.
And we delve into the foster care crisis in America.
Imagine being 5 years old and suddenly being surrounded by strangers. You're in a strange bed. You're with strange sounds. They'll be terrified.
Then we learn about the number one selling alcohol brand that you've never heard of.
You want to be at every store. Like, anybody could just walk into a store and see Soju there. That's our main goal.
The creators of Mr. Show explain why they've released a book of old, rejected scripts.
The satirical side of it, the points we're making, are just as relevant than when we wrote it 15 years ago.
And Roots bandleader Questlove reveals the secret to recording an album with Elvis Costello.
I did everything but plot a kidnapping and tortured this record out of him.
That's all in this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. But first, an introduction. This is my first week on the show, and we have moved west. Every weekend, we'll be broadcasting from our new home in Culver City, California. It's an American archetype, or cliche. For the better part of the last century, from Steinbeck to the Muppets, you moved west to follow your dream.
Tickets for the west at this window. One ticket for the west. End of line.
Yes, sir.
Westward roll the wagons, always west.
Story of the man who blazed the way for a new frontier.
With its spirited romance.
A new life.
Its lusty old west
fun. And the promised land.
There'll be no quitting along the way. Not by me and not by you.
Baby, and I'm on my way. Here's my beret. I'm going Hollywood.
But California and the American West, these places are no longer anyone's frontier. And life on this side of the Mississippi is much more complicated than any Western could capture. There's no single icon in sprawling, diverse Los Angeles, no White House or St. Louis Arch, but Angelenos consistently told us the one spot we had to visit.
Go to Griffith Park.
Griffith Park.
Gosh, Griffith Park. Go to the observatory and look at the views.
I love the Griffith Observatory. I think it's a great place to go.
The observatory, with a vantage high over L.A. And so, that's where we came. It's that rare foggy day in Los Angeles, but from this high up, here at the observatory, you can see a sprawling panorama that stretches from the iconic Hollywood sign across downtown L.A. and all the way to the coast.
They film a lot of stuff up here. This is a perfect location for the movies.
Yeah. That's our guide to L.A., NPR's Mandalit Del Barco, who's a reporter from the city for 20 years.
Welcome to L.A.
So right here, the city is laid out behind us beautifully. It's a little bit smoggy, but we can still see a whole lot of stuff in front of us.
And from here you can see how diverse LA is, geographically, economically, and just with the people. You can see from the Hollywood Hills all the way to Venice Beach, from the inner city to the biggest port in the country, multi-million dollar mansions, low-income housing, strip malls, the latest architectural designs.
Right.
So one thing you should know about LA is that half of the Angelenos are Latino.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the city was first a Mexican settlement in the 1700s. And in the public schools, 74% of the kids are Latino. In fact, in the schools, they speak 93 different languages.
Wow.
Other than English. So many of those families have been here for generations and generations. But a lot of people have just moved here, like you have, from right. Other parts of the world, other parts of the country.
And one of the great things about coming from other parts of the country is that because of all that diversity, you can find what you like here. Like, I don't feel like I'm at home until I can find a nice samosa and a nice cup of chai. And I found that within about 5 minutes in L.A. And everything else in between, like Ethiopian food. Randomly stumbled across a Persian neighborhood where all of a sudden there were just Iranian bookstores and music stores.
Absolutely. That's not all. We have Little Saigon, Little Tokyo, Filipino town, little Armenia, little Ethiopia, little Bangladesh, little Moscow, and there's also a part that's called Tarongelis.
Maybe that's where I was, in Tarongelis.
That's right. You know, here in LA, we have hipsters, we have gang members, we have movie stars, and we have what we like to call real people,
and
so-called.
You talked to some people for us that you think kind of exemplify the feeling of the spirit of the city.
That's right. I want to introduce you to a few of them.
Hi, I'm Chef Roy Choi.
from L.A. and I rep the Kogi truck. I love L.A. because you can be free. You don't have to live up to anyone's expectations or rules. And you can create a whole new life for yourself.
Like you did.
Yeah, like I did.
You were one of the pioneers of the food truck movement, right, with your Korean tacos.
Yeah, and the thing about L.A. is that the food truck started here for the USA. So, like, we were like the kids of the food truck movement, and we brought our own flavor to it, you know.
You see New York? It's more better here. My name is Vilma Chacon. I born in El Salvador, pero I live here in America. I am citizen. I live in for here for 43 years.
What's your favorite part of L.A.?
Everything. Work, the food, the people, everything. Disneyland, Universal Studios, the ocean is beautiful. Rodeo Drive.
Rodeo Drive.
Yeah, I love Rodeo Drive. Because I work in, for Bel Air and Beverly Hills for the movie stars.
You worked for the movie stars and their homes.
I am the babysitter, the two kids.
I'm Ike Barinholtz from The Mindy Project, Tuesdays 9:30, 8:30 Central. I love Los Angeles because it is an actual city that thrives and exists because of art. Even though when I call myself an artist, I want to vomit, I still feel like I am a member of the community, and it really does exist because of people making television and movies and plays and writing books and music, so I think that's pretty special. I love L.A. as much, if not more, than Randy Newman.
That was great, Mondaleet. And, of course, as much love as we have for L.A., we know there's a lot to discover in the rest of the West. And since we've moved here, we've heard from a couple of other NPR folks with something to say about the other stories we shouldn't miss.
Here in Seattle, I'm Martin Costi, speaking to you from the waterfront in downtown Seattle. You've probably seen this postcard before. There's the float planes flying over my head, the ferries crossing the Sound, a lot of people wearing fleeces, and if you pay attention when you walk down the street or through the parks, you'll detect a certain skunk of secondhand pot smoke. But the thing you have to understand about this area is that it's not all Portlandia. In fact, there's kind of a division here. It runs from west to east. For example, here in Seattle, right now, there's a tight mayor's race between two liberal Democrats. But as soon as you drive over the Cascade Mountains, a funny thing happens. First, it stops raining. But second, the politics shift to red. Some people call this the Cascade Curtain. You feel the Cold War vibe the most when there's a close governor's race in Washington. And it's a cultural divide, too. Living here in Seattle, I often catch myself saying out west, when what I mean to say is east. Because, well, let's face it, east of here, things feel a lot more cowboy. But even that division can be too simplistic sometimes. People east of here are more conservative, but they're not predictably so. There's a libertarian streak. For instance, when Washington voters legalized pot last year, it passed in Spokane, too. And it actually came close to 50-50 in a lot of the eastern counties. So while there is a Cascade Curtain in this region, you can also detect that certain funky odor wafting around on both sides. In Seattle, this is Martin Costi.
Hi Arun, Ted Robbins here, standing in the sunshine at the top of Gates Pass in the Tucson Mountains. Turn one way and there's civilization, homes, stores, offices, and air conditioning. Turn the other and there's a fantastic landscape. Thousands of giant saguaro cactus, the ones with the arms, dot the mountainsides in front of me. It's the classic Sonoran desert picture. A picture doesn't convey the main thing I'm feeling, though, right now, hot. Even with October in sight, it's still 100 degrees out here. But it's a dry heat. That's the old saying, anyway. I can see forever from here. Mexico is just 60 miles south. Border Patrol vehicles are crisscrossing the desert below me, as they do now all over the Southwest, from here east through the New Mexico-Chile fields. North, past Phoenix and Albuquerque to Flagstaff and Santa Fe, the desert gives way to forests. Cold takes over from hot. It's a diverse region, more diverse than most folks realize. In some places, Latino, American Indian, and Anglo cultures mix together easily, food, music, even politics. In other places, there's enough friction for protest marches. As for the heat here, it'll be gone soon. While the northern and eastern U.S. are bundling up, I'll be getting on my bike or putting on my hiking boots to enjoy the sunshine, which turns from brutal to balmy for the next 8 months. In Arizona, I'm Ted Robbins.
This is Wade Goodwin in Dallas. Arun, here's what you need to know about Texas. Texas is the land of stalwart conservative politicians. To borrow a phrase from our freshman U.S. senator, you're not going to find a bunch of cheese-eating surrender monkeys governing the Lone Star State, no sir. Senator Ted Cruz and Governor Rick Perry are leading the way to save the American people from the train wreck that is Obamacare. They say it's now or never because once people get health insurance, they'll get so addicted they'll never give it up. But this is Texas, and we all know what's really important in life, not politics, college football. I'm standing here at the Cotton Bowl. How about that Fighting Texas Aggie quarterback, Johnny Hancock? No, I mean Johnny Football. Darn it, I knew I was going to do that. Anyway, Manziel showed them Alabama boys last year was no fluke, didn't he? I thought Nick Saban was going to have a coronary in the fourth quarter. Speaking of the Alabama coach, the big money donors at my alma mater, the University of Texas, have old Nick on speed dial these days. That's because in the last 2 weeks, the Texas defense gave up 275,000 yards rushing to BYU and Ole Miss. That's school record. If Texas loses again tonight against Kansas State and goes 1-3, it could make that whole Egypt brouhaha look like a Tri-Delt sorority party. I'm Wade Goodwin in Dallas. Arun, God bless Texas.
Mandalit, wherever our reporting travels take us, we'll have much to look forward to when we get back to our new home in Culver City.
Yeah, you know, Arun, you can find everything here in L.A. Everyone is youthful, no matter what their age. You can surf, you can legally smoke pot, you can do the latest yoga craze. We've got great food, great weather, and Arun, there is no shortage of news. It's a really fun place to be a journalist.
Sounds like it. Really excited, and we plan on covering all of that. Not just the West. We're going to be looking out at the whole country, and indeed the world, just from a new vantage point. At Griffith Observatory, I'm Arun Roth. Nature writer Jackson Landers takes a lot of risks in the wild. He's ended up in the emergency room a bunch of times. Most recently, he found himself in the hospital after a run-in with a black widow spider living on his front porch.
When I finally got bitten, I really should have known better. I knew that they were there on that front porch, and I had left a pair of water shoes, like aqua socks, on the front porch. I'd been writing all day, and I decided to go catch dinner. And so I grabbed the shoes and a cast net and some a fishing pole, and I drove about 5 miles to the fishing spot, got out of the car, and I put the shoes on. I took a few steps, and I felt a stinging sensation. And at first, I thought maybe it was I had a thorn or something in the shoe. And then it got worse, and it felt like an insect bite. It felt like a bee sting or something. I took the shoe off. I saw two tiny little pinpricks, and I knew it wasn't a bee sting. It was something had bitten me. I was sort of in denial about what was happening. I walked down to the water, and I went fishing, and I caught 3 catfish. And as I was fishing, the pain got worse and worse. I felt this warmth in my abdomen, and the warmth turned into a tightness. And then the tightness turned into pain, and it was like being punched in the stomach. And that was when I knew that I had to get out of there while I was still able to drive. The venom is a neurotoxin. It causes muscle spasms and contractions. And by the time I got out into the parking lot in the ER, it was like a vice grabbing my abdomen. This doctor, this toxicologist, sat down and talked to me for a while, and he said, listen, we're doing this study with an experimental new anti-venom. Would you be willing to test it? And I said, what's your track record? He said, well, you'd be the fourth person to volunteer. So what happened with the last ones? He said, well, I think two of them got the placebo. When they finally put this substance into my IV, there were, I think, 14 or 15 people in the room. It was this moment of incredible tension, and I felt something. It was almost a high. It was this incredible, magical warmth that spread through my arm, and I could feel it spreading, through my arm and through my chest, and it was a wave of relief as pain was erased, literally, with every heartbeat pushing a little bit farther. And within 10 minutes, I was completely recovered. I felt fine. And they were able to discharge me just a few hours later. It was the first time they'd seen a black widow bite that didn't need to be admitted. I was discharged at 3 a.m., and I went home, and I collapsed into bed. And I woke up at some point the next day. I went downstairs to make a cup of coffee, and I saw a spider crawling on the floor. And right there was a male black widow. And I took a few pictures of it, and then that guy had to go.
Jackson Landers has moved out of the spider-infested house, but he says whenever he sees a messy web close to the ground, he can't help but stop and stare. From NPR West, it's All Things Considered, I'm Arun Roth. It's one of the monuments of American literature, Herman Melville's Moby Dick. The Los Angeles Library System posed a challenge to Twitter followers recently. Send us your best 140-character summary of the novel. Among the responses they received, epic pale whale fail, Ishmael goes fishing with Ahab, who has male fish issues, and we're going to need a bigger metaphor. Those three were submitted by comedian Patton Oswalt, and today his contribution grew beyond 140 characters. Patton has been barnstorming three L.A. area libraries today, reading excerpts from Moby Dick and leading group discussions about the book. It seems he's got his own obsession with the white whale. I spoke with Oswalt before he embarked, and I asked him why he wanted to do it.
The novel Moby Dick is my Moby Dick in that I've taken all these runs at it, but I've never actually managed to finish it. I've taken big bites. I've read excerpts. There are all these intriguing elements of it, but I've never captured the whole of it. So I thought this would be really fun to do, go to three L.A. area libraries, and then talking with whomever shows up about, especially because the first library that I'm reading at is the Will and Ariel Durant branch, and they there are some very extreme personalities that frequent that particular branch.
How so?
How do I put it? There's a lot of people in there that are clutching their manifestos. So they all, it is like, I'm reading an excerpt of Moby Dick in a room full of people pursuing their own psychologically damaged versions of Moby Dick. So maybe they'll give me the spark and insight out of left field that'll make me just power all the way through this novel once and for all.
So they think, like, this is all about class conflict, or this is about sex, or...
That, I mean, again, that shows you what a great novel this is. It can serve anyone's purpose. It can serve anyone's agenda, and it can serve anyone's pathology, really. It's written through the viewpoint of a very damaged, lonely, moody guy that is just trying to fill the time in between his depressions, which I think for certain people, they're like, yes, that's, oh my God. So.
Sounds like Taxi Driver.
Yeah, exactly. And it also implies that before going on this whaling voyage, Ahab traveled the world and convinced some very dangerous people that you shouldn't go talk to go, I need you to come up to New England, cold, awful New England, United States, and get on my crappy ship, and we're going to go kill this whale, and it's not going to benefit you. I'm just in a really bad – and he somehow – he's like this Jim Jones, Charles Manson type. It's like Jim Jones recruiting Charles Manson. Right. That's what's going on this ship.
What do you make of the fact that these are like these archetypical like American characters that –
Because the reason America became the superpower that it is, I'm convinced, is because it was – and someone else pointed this out to me, a comedian named Bob Summerby back in Baltimore. He goes, America was not founded by stable, emotionally even people. It was founded by religious extremists who didn't think that church was miserable enough in England. They wanted to make it worse. So they got on these horrible ships, went across oceans that they thought were filled with monsters to another country where they thought the woods were filled with demons – and then just kept pushing westward. Everything about America is dissatisfaction. We're driven by a foul mood, and we're driven by obsession. But that's, in a weird way, it's why we rule the world, because we're the crazy obsessive person. You know, it's weird how you look at the quality of life in places like Sweden and Finland is better. And I think one of the reasons their quality of life is better is because they're like, we're number 7, and we're cool with that. We actually – because run. It's like – if you're a driver for Domino's Pizza, that's a pretty cool job. But if you're the manager, you have ulcers and stress. You're constantly trying to meet these quotas. You know. So Ishmael and Ahab are that in microcosm, basically.
Ahab is like a Domino's manager.
He is the stressed-out manager who is crushing up no-dos and snorting it so he can work two shifts. And he has drivers that won't listen to him, and he's screaming at everybody. And he has to meet that 30-minute limit everywhere. And they have all kinds of dumb promotions he has to keep on top of. It's a nightmare.
So what sections did you choose to read for your library readings?
Well, I'm gonna read obviously the very famous opening paragraph, which the thing about the opening paragraph is it's way more famous for its first line, mm-hmm. and then people don't go into what the actual paragraph is, which is a pretty dark portrait of the guy we're about to spend 900 pages with. It is, you know, everyone thinks Ishmael is this hardy New England sailor, like kind of a Matt Damon type, like, here we go, it's going to be really fun and upbeat. And then you read his first paragraph, and you're like, this guy is more like a Leonard Cohen or a, you know, this guy is really gloomy.
Do you want to read that for us?
I want to read this.
People don't get beyond Call Me Ishmael.
Yeah, this is what happens after the sentence. And it's and by the way, the name of the chapter is Loomings, for God's sake. So it's like a guy journaling in the morning and writing about his depression. So listen to this. And there's going to be a lot of people in a lot of Starbucks who listen to this going, oh, God, that was my blog post yesterday. This is a blog post. This opening is a depressed teenage blog post. Here we go. Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long, precisely, having little or no money in my purse and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It is a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses. This guy's like a goth. He literally is a goth. Sorry. And bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet. Ishmael, come on! And especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand on me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street. I'm sorry, like Morrissey would read this and go, dude, you need to turn a cartwheel, talk to some children. To prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. This is my substitute for pistol and ball. With a philosophical flourish, Cato throws himself upon his sword. I quietly take to the ship. There's nothing surprising in this. Oh, yes, there is, Ishmael. If they but knew it, almost all men in their degree, sometime or other, cherish very nearly the same feelings towards the oceans with me. Ishmael, no, they don't, dude, because they're not thinking of stepping into traffic, falling on a sword, shooting themselves, following funerals around, and hanging around in front of coffin warehouses. Good God. Wow. Anyway, so that was that. So again, okay, folks, there's your Ishmael. Go hang out with him.
And this is our narrator, and this is one of the less messed up people on that boat.
This is the stable guy that we turn to tell us the story. Everyone else in the boat is crazier than him. Ahab's gone around the world and gathered up all these religious extremists, the Zoroastrians and stuff, that he keeps just chained, or not even chained, they just want to be down in the hold. Like, he's assembled this Justice League of obsessives that he's going to unleash on the whale. So that aspect of it is, what is going on underneath the planks, the deck of the Pequod? They hint at it, but it's pretty dark.
We were talking a bit before we started about how this book has just had such an amazing cultural resonance. My own favorite would be Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, Wrath of Khan is Moby Dick in space, with Kirk is the white whale, and Khan is, of course, Ahab.
And they pull lines actually straight out of the book that they give.
He screams Moby Dick lines at Captain Kirk. From hell's heart, I stab at thee. And then you said you'd already seen Wrath of Khan. Then when you read it, you went, oh, that's where they got this.
That's where they got those great lines for Khan. Ripped off Melville. What a great book.
Yeah, exactly. It would be really fascinating if some nutball over at HBO or Showtime, some obsessive, did a massive miniseries like a John Adams or a Rome, but we're doing Moby Dick.
Who would you cast?
Ahab and Ishmael, let me think. Oh, yeah, easy. Seth Rogen and James Franco. I cast. You know who might be a really interesting, the go-to choice in my head would be Christopher Walken as Ahab.
Uh-huh.
But also Tommy Lee Jones would be really interesting And then as Ishmael, maybe wait a minute. Paul Dano is Ishmael and Daniel Day-Lewis is Ahab. Good God, it's right there. It's right there.
That's comedian Patton Oswalt. He spent the day at various L.A. area libraries reading aloud from Moby Dick. Patton Oswalt, thank you so much.
Thank you for this was great. Thank you.
Meet Claudia Felder. She lives in Chino, California. And like many 21-year-olds these days, she's back with her parents. It's a wholesome scene. Nice house, three dogs and a parrot. Happy family pictures everywhere. Claudia spent much of her childhood in foster care, starting when she was three. Now she's been living happily with her adoptive family, but memories of an abusive past still haunt her.
To this day, every now and then I'll have a nightmare, and it's of my biological mom getting the crap beat out of her in a motel room, and she had long hair, but her face is always, like, fuzzed out, so I never remember, like, what she looks like. I can't recall that.
From there, Claudia entered the foster care system, where she spent the better part of the next 10 years. That's our cover story today, Foster Care in America. How are we caring for our most vulnerable children? You were three when you first went into foster care. That's really young. Do you have coherent memories of it? Or
I remember the homes, and some of them I remember the names of the parents. Right. I wasn't brought into like a normal situation.
Nothing to compare it to.
Yeah, this is all I knew.
Yeah.
Always moving, never knowing when I was going to leave. I was lucky enough that when I was in foster care, I did have my little sister with me.
Which, what was the age difference?
She's 3 years younger than me, so she was a baby. I raised my little sister through foster care. That's all we had was each other. Granted, she was a baby. That still meant more to me than anything that somebody I at least knew going through all these other changes in my life.
And there were plenty of changes. Claudia says they were moving in and out of foster homes, not knowing where they'd end up next or how long they'd have to stay.
I had about 6 foster homes, and all but one were physically and sexually abusive. So I experienced it with my biological parents and then 5 other homes. So it was like an ongoing thing.
It seemed like the nightmare would finally end when Claudia and her sister were adopted. She had already, by the age of 6, been in 5 foster homes, and it had taken its toll. It was difficult to adjust to the home life, and she got in trouble in school.
I had a lot of trust issues, a lot of abandonment issues, a lot of resentment towards the world, and I didn't know what was causing them or like who they were directed at or any of that kind of stuff.
After 4 years in that house, Claudia says the family wanted her out. At age 10, they sent her packing, back into foster care. But she left alone. The family wanted to keep her younger sister. It was devastating.
Because it's the person I've been with for 7 years, because she was raised, you know, that's been my constant. They promised up and down that they'd be able to visit, and I think I wanted to believe that, and not till later did I figure out it was not true. So,
you know, they'll get pulled from their home at 5 or 6, and a van will come to them in the middle of the night, and they'll take the kid. The kid is terrified, and they'll be put with a stranger.
Chris Beam has spent years researching foster care in America and is a foster parent herself.
I mean, imagine being 5 years old and suddenly being surrounded by strangers. You're in a strange bed. You're with strange sounds. They'll be terrified. They don't understand what's happening.
Beam says that all too often, these bewildered children will act out in various ways that can scare off ill-prepared foster parents who might otherwise adopt, much like Claudia's situation.
We have 400,000 kids in care, so to give you an idea of what that even looks like, if you imagine all of the kids in Chicago public schools, elementary, junior high, high school, all in Chicago, that's about how many we have in foster care.
Beam says the problems foster kids face are so intractable because they are society's problems. It's impossible to address the foster care problem without tackling broader issues of drug abuse, domestic and sexual abuse, and poverty.
They are a meter of a lot of our social problems. They're not just a meter of how child welfare is failing or succeeding. They're a meter of how we are failing or succeeding as a society.
We need to focus on how we're going to prevent this problem in the first place.
Alex Morales is the CEO of the Children's Bureau of Southern California.
The answer is, how do you reduce the situation so that you don't have 140,000 reports going on in a year, and you try to start very early with families right when the child is born, or offer support in the early years, and prevention's ultimately the direction we need to invest in.
But while prevention may be the key, Morales says there's still an ongoing crisis in L.A. foster care that reflects a national problem. There just aren't enough homes to take in kids.
The issue is there are only about 3,000 foster homes, and not more than about 5 years ago, there were twice as many homes. The children have no place to go when they come into the care of the government or the courts. Where do we put them?
The answer is institutions, group homes. These aren't the old orphanages out of Charles Dickens, but according to Morales, the conditions in many group homes can be just as bleak. With overcrowding, kids end up sleeping in cots in adoption agencies. Essentially, office buildings become home. And most social workers agree that even the best group home is no match for a real family, and it doesn't need to be a traditional one. Morales says that only a family can give these kids the kind of support they need.
They're the final defenders of a child's future by saying, look, the family's failed them, the system has failed them, and we're going to try to step in and be the last solution to catch this child before they go off the cliff into homelessness and jails.
Yep.
After her first adoption failed, Claudia spent almost 7 months in a new foster home. She said it wasn't perfect, but it's where she met a new social worker, someone she could trust. They talked about what Claudia wanted.
And I remember, like, talking about, like, I hear kids at school talking about sleepovers. Like, what are they? Like, I've always wanted to have, like, a sleepover, like, with a friend. Like, the little things that a lot of people just take for granted. It's, like, the things that a lot of kids and myself at that age, like, just longed for.
That social worker turned her life around.
Oh, by the way, this social worker is now my mom. Yes.
The nice woman standing right behind us right now, right? Meet Kim Felder.
I always say I'm a really bad foster parent because once they walk in the door, that's it. They're not leaving.
If you just wanted to adopt kids, you could have done that in a way that would be pose much less difficulty. So what is it about the foster aspect that you want to give of yourself in that way? Because it's a lot more difficult than
part of it is I probably like the challenge. And my husband and I mean, when Claudia would pull some of her things, I mean, you'd get frustrated. It's like, oh my gosh, I cannot believe this. And then when they do the little amazing thing, like the first band concert, or they graduate from high school, inside you're saying, oh my God, do you know how far this kid has come? Have you seen what they can do?
Kim and her husband have had that feeling over and over. They have 8 kids, including Claudia, 6 of whom are adopted. Kim and Claudia are looking at the pictures, which are proudly displayed. So this is your whole family?
Minus the youngest. There's my dad and mom. So I'm the oldest of the girls. And then it's Jenny, Maggie, and Jessie's the youngest. But this was 5 months before she was placed with us. And then it's my oldest brother. Well, there's Jim. Then my other brother. There's Paul. There's Joe. And there's Robbie. And then Paul's wife, Jim's wife, and the 2 grandbabies at the time, and then they had another. So.
All in matching jeans and white T-shirt. And, like,
we're at Santa Monica Pier.
Santa Monica Pier.
Yeah.
Claudia has a happy ending that is not the story for a lot of kids. Chris Beam says that for many older kids who don't end up with families, cynicism sets in. And around 12 or 13, they decide to run out the clock and wait for emancipation. Once they turn 18, they can go out on their own. Beam says being independent without strong family support is dangerous.
The reality is these kids, they need someone to fall back on. They need parents when they're 20 or 23. I mean, think about when you had your first heartbreak, your first job loss, your first crush, your first crash, your first anything. And when kids hit any little stumble at all, they don't need to know how to balance a checkbook. They need to have somebody that they can call upon. What we really need to be finding for them are families. And by family, I mean one person to say, you know what, I'm going to stick by you. I'm going to care about you. I'm going to love you for a long time.
Today, Claudia does outreach work with foster kids, and she's trying to make them understand why they need that support.
A lot of these kids are just like I was. They don't want to be adopted. Right. they have 4 years and I'll be 18 and I'll be off on my own and I'll survive. I can't change your mind, but make a connection with at least somebody. You need to have somebody in your life.
It seems like we only hear about the foster care system when horror stories come out. And Chris Beam and Alex Morales both agree that good outcomes like Claudia's are as, that good outcomes like Claudia's are just as much a part of the picture. But sadly, even a successful adoption isn't the end of the story for these kids. According to one Harvard study, 25% of foster kids in America have post-traumatic stress disorder. That's in the same range as veterans from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Here's a story with a twist. The world's best-selling brand of alcoholic spirit is something most Americans have never heard of, let alone tasted. So if you're thinking whiskey, tequila, vodka, nope. It's not Smirnoff or Jack Daniels. It's not Bacardi rum. None of those. The trade magazine Drinks International's annual list of top-selling alcohols in the world is led this year by another dominant brand. NPR's Tom Dreisbach has the answer and the story of how the best-selling brand in the world is trying to connect in America.
Those other brands, they don't even come close. Every year, this drink more than doubles the sales of the next closest competitor, and it manages that feat with the help of one major spokesperson. That's right, Psy from Korea is the spokesperson, and the top-selling brand in the world is Korea's Jinro Soju. It's a clear spirit, traditionally made of rice, about 20% alcohol, with a light, slightly sweet taste. And the reason you've probably never heard of it is because Jinro does less than 5% of its sales in the U.S., makes up for that by dominating the market in Korea and doing brisk business in Japan and China. Now Jinro's American operation wants to expand with the help of Psy.
When Psy blew up, I saw that as growth, as like a culture. This fat Korean guy comes out singing in Korean. And everybody loves him.
That's Tae Kim. He's the sales and marketing manager for Jinro America. And remember that the Gangnam Style YouTube video is now closing in on 2 billion views. That's with a B. Patty Kang runs the advertising strategy for Jinro America.
The Korean culture is now becoming the hip culture.
Kang is also Korean American. And she says she saw this play out at a recent K-pop concert in L.A. By the way, that stands for Korean pop.
There were about 20,000 screaming teenagers.
LA.
And I would say about 80% of the screaming teenagers were non-Korean.
Really?
It shocked me.
She's dragging, baby. Yes,
Kang says that Korean Americans are already sold on soju.
We're not alcoholics, so we don't have it at every single meal. But if it's any type of gathering, friends, family, whatnot, soju is always there and it just goes with the food.
Now Jinro is trying to reach people who have no connection to Korean culture. They've started a partnership with the Los Angeles Dodgers and sold soju at games. They've got Psy up on billboards around L.A. Here's Tae Kim from Jinro.
We want to be at every store. Like anybody could just walk into a store and see soju there. That's our main goal.
How realistic do you think that is?
Unrealistic, I would say.
That's Hamish Smith on the phone. He's a deputy editor for Drinks International magazine. He's the guy that wrote this year's report on the top-selling spirits. Smith says there is a precedent for a new spirit entering the American market. In the 1950s, there was another foreign alcohol trying to make it big in the States, vodka. And vodka is now the top-selling spirit in America.
You might argue that if vodka could do it, a Russian, Polish spirit, then why not? But I kind of feel like that place has been filled.
Soju has one key advantage over vodka. Alcohol content. Because it's around 20%, restaurants and bars in some places don't need a full liquor license to sell soju, just a beer and wine license, which is easier and cheaper to get. It's a weekday afternoon at a bar called the Bank of Venice. They're right off the boardwalk on California's Venice Beach. And they're crafting the soju versions of mojitos and margaritas and other cocktails. Megan Cross is a bartender.
If you take vodka, its characteristics are colorless, flavorless, odorless. That's premium. So soju, in some respects, is the same, but just lower proof. So it lends itself to be manipulated.
And even though soju has less alcohol content, the bartender can just double the volume. But it's not always an easy sell in tourist-heavy Venice Beach.
Because of our location, you are getting the people that just want to get wasted, you know, that just want a shot of Jameson. And it's hard to say, I'm not full liquor, but I have soju. And it's like, what language are you speaking?
But they must be doing something right. Thomas Elliott owns the Bank of Venice, as well as another bar that mixes soju cocktails. He says the decision to serve soju has nothing to do with the Korean culture and everything to do with his bottom line.
It's absolutely a business decision. It's either, you know, have an alternative for your customers who want a different kind of a beverage or not be able to serve them.
Masao Miyashiro is sitting at the bar. He seems a little skeptical, but he listened closely to the bartender's pitch. So, would you be willing to try one of these cocktails?
You know, now that I've been listening to this whole thing, I think I might try the mint.
He actually ends up sticking with a beer, a longboard lager. So there's skepticism for soju to overcome here. Still, there's every indication that Jinro will outsell all its competitors again next year, with or without the U.S. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
From NPR West, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Arun Roth. There's an old joke about the Velvet Underground, that only 100 people bought their first album, but every one of them started a band. When it comes to sketch comedy in America, that's how I think of Mr. Show with Bob and David. When it came on HBO 20 years ago, there was nothing like it. Dark, subversive, riotously funny sketches tied together with bizarre and brilliant segues, sort of reminiscent of Monty Python's Flying Circus. And while it seemed that nobody was watching it at the time, those of us in the know would pass around videotapes of Mr. Show like it was a forbidden treasure. Its influence on American comedy has been on the scale of Monty Python. And some of the regulars on Mr. Show have gone on to huge careers. Sarah Silverman and Jack Black, for instance, or Tom Kenny, who you might know as SpongeBob SquarePants. Bob Odenkirk and David Cross, the creators of Mr. Show, join me now. They have a new book of old material. It's called Hollywood Said No, and it's a collection of scripts rejected by Hollywood. I'm thrilled to say, hey, everybody, it's Bob and David.
Hey, how's it going?
So pick up the story from here and correct me if I'm getting the setup here wrong. Mr. Show, it's the mid-90s. It's hailed by critics and comedy fans. Its fourth season, though, it gets buried on Mondays at midnight and does poorly in the ratings, and HBO cancels it. Is that right so far?
Yeah, that's good.
Pretty much.
I mean,
it.
We were actually in the midst of shooting our final shows at the time, and all the air went out of the Enterprise, as it were. And I remember about a month and a half, 2 months later, I think I told you this. I was getting gas at a station, and a guy pulls up. He's getting gas, and he goes, "Bob Odenkirk, oh, I'm a huge Mr. Show fan. I thought you guys were going to do another season." I mean, like, he had been looking for it.
And it had been airing.
And it had been airing, and he'd completely missed it. So even our fans couldn't find us.
It was kind of a dark, subversive show for the sort of, you know, happy-go-lucky 90s. I want to give people sort of a sense of it who may not be familiar with it. So what we're going to do is we're going to play a little bit of a sketch. It's called Operation Hell on Earth. David, you're playing the leader of a hate group. It's kind of an unusual hate group, though.
This is what America's going to look like after the mandatory relocation is enforced.
A lot of the people one would assume the leader would hate comprise this group. It's a suburban mix of everybody.
Everything. There's a gay guy, a woman, a black guy.
New York City will become known as Little Israel. I figure all the Jews will love that. Is that okay, Ms. Shapiro?
That's fine, Ken.
Okay.
And we're all sort of feeling sorry for the leader of our hate group and trying to buck him up. You know, basically, it's almost like the community's deciding, look, he wants a hate group. Let's help him out. Everybody show up. Bring your best attitude.
Will you keep in touch? Of course I will, Regent.
And Bob, you're an Indian.
And I play an Indian.
This is Ken's one thing, Operation Hell on the Earth, the victory of the white race. You know? Let's make it happen. Okay, thanks, Regent.
Bob, I love your Indian accent.
He worked on that for a long time. He went to
10 minutes.
He went to Delhi for 10 minutes to bone up.
And I feel like this is sort of a quintessential sort of Mr. Show sketch of just this riotously funny stuff. It's hilarious, you know. But at the same time, you know, it's so dark, and it's about hate.
Yeah, it's about friendliness, too. It's not just hate. They really feel for this guy, and they want him to succeed. And, you know, they're nice folks.
So going back to when you found out, not that the show was canceled, but that you weren't going to be coming back for another one, was that hard to take? Did you start to think about a new Mr. Show project or a movie right away?
We did do a movie.
Run, Ronnie, Run. Yeah.
Run, Ronnie, Run, which sort of was derived from Mr. Show. Have you ever seen it?
I had to work hard to find it.
Good. That was a kind of a debacle of its own. So,
like, why was Run, Ronnie, Run a debacle?
We assumed it was going to be a collaborative work in which we'd have kind of the same amount of control that we had on our show, what made us successful enough to get to do this movie. And in part, we were rewriting it and rewriting it and rewriting it and making it each step of the way a little bit less Mr. Show and more kind of that 90-minute comedy movie that was popular back then.
When they were coming out with all these movies based around Saturday Night Live characters.
Exactly, exactly.
Once it was done shooting, we were out, completely out, like totally frozen out.
And that's where you really make a movie.
Yeah, that's where you make a movie in editing.
So this book that you have right now, these are your rejected scripts.
Hollywood said no, and it's got two full-length screenplays in it and three or four sketches, as well as a couple little funny bits that we wrote just for the book. After we did Run, Ronnie, Run, we thought, you know what, we screwed up by trying to reach out too far to the industry and write this character-based narrative. Let's just write a sketch movie. That's what we do. Well, we wrote the Hooray for America first. Which was a very Mr. Show satirical film where David is an actor named David Cross, and a corporation decides to run him for president. And he's an actor, so he's completely malleable, and he becomes president.
Did you actually pitch Hooray for America to studios?
Yeah,
or did you decide on your own, like, no, they're not going to?
Did we? I think we might have.
I think we shared it with people. But we always knew that we needed some special relationship to get a movie made. Neither of us thought, you know, that the basic industry of Hollywood was eager to make a Mr. Show movie. We just thought, we'll write a good script, and maybe somehow we'll cross our fingers and we'll meet an angel.
A patron of the arts.
A patron of the arts who will make it. But that never happened, so they didn't get made. And in the case of Hooray for America, the story about David running for president, I mean, the satirical side of it, the points we're making are just as relevant today, if not more relevant, than when we wrote it 15 years ago. I mean, with the Citizens United decision, it's basically all as true as it could ever be now.
You guys really savaged the movie business. How did Hollywood executives, when you're pitching them a film in which portrays Hollywood executives as really despicable human beings, didn't they take that poorly?
Guys, trust me, none of those guys see themselves ever as that person. That goes with agents. Man, anybody on that side of the carpet in Hollywood will often read something that is, you know, they are part of an amalgamation of that kind of character, and they go, "That's great, hey man, I love it. I love your takedown of the typical agent." You know, hey, they make me wear this suit. We've heard that line a couple times, but nobody ever sees themselves. They don't. And one thing I want to make clear, and we mentioned this early on in the book, in the preface, I believe, is Bob and I in no way feel like we've been victimized, that it's that you should feel sorry for us, you know, and we don't feel that way. We don't want to be perceived that way. We just think there's value to the scripts. We still think they're funny, but, and, you know, it's a business. And
you guys are doing well in the business. I mean, you know, David, with you on Arrested Development, which has just been huge. And you know, Bob, of course, like, I'm waiting to see what happens with Saul Goodman.
So is he.
Listen, we've had great careers. I think we both feel that way. We've had our down times, but we've learned a lot and made a lot of great projects and also made a living. So that's all you can ask, you know.
Bob and David, this was a real treat. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, man.
Thank
My pleasure.
You.
Bob Odenkirk and David Cross. Their new book is called Hollywood Said No. Orphaned film scripts, bastard scenes, and abandoned darlings from the creators of Mr. Show. Once again, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Now, if I'm allowed to make the call, check out the coolest musical partnership of the year. Musician Elvis Costello has been a frequent guest on NBC's Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. There, Costello got to work with Late Night's in-house band, The Roots, and he struck up a working relationship with the band's leader, Amir Thompson, also known as Questlove. That became a friendship, and that friendship, a collaboration. Elvis Costello and The Roots have just released a new album. It's called Wise Up Ghost and Other Songs. I can tell the time by the color of my skin, and I know my neighbor, cause he's the one. Now, the way I tell the story about the collaboration is the nice version. The way Questlove tells it is a bit more sinister.
Me and Steve Mandel did everything but plot a kidnapping and tortured this record out of him.
Steve Mandel is The Roots recording engineer.
He declared to me that Elvis Costello is the greatest living artist ever. So when I did my initial interview with Lorne Michaels and Jimmy Fallon, and they were giving me scenarios of how this could be a good look for The Roots to take this late night gig, one of the examples was, quote, and Thursday nights, you know, like someone like Elvis Costello can come in and sit in. And so when I quoted that to Steve, then the light bulb, bing, went off. And he's like, dude, we can get to Elvis this way. And then once we got him on the radar, we had to reprogram ourselves to not geek out. You know, I have a Japanese import of Imperial Bedroom and, da-da-da. You know, like none of that stuff, like nothing. And we maintained our composure three times in a row. And then after the third appearance, then it was like, okay, we got him. Let's get him.
So, Elvis, when did you become aware of the conspiracy to kidnap you?
He's just finding out now. We're just coming out.
The room is locked and I can't get out.
Yeah.
No, but here's the other way around of it. You know, when I first came into the show, I said to Kareem Riggins, who is a friend of Amir's, who plays drums with my wife, Diana Krall, do you think those guys would play with me if I went on the show? I know they back people sometimes. And so we started having a dialogue about what the song would be. And I thought, well, I made this record with a lot of references to 60s R&B called Get Happy. And I thought this song, High Fidelity, maybe would be a good one. And then they said, yeah, we want to do it in the arrangement from 1979, where it was all slowed down and sounded like Station to Station by David Bowie.
That should have been warning right there.
That should have been the red flag.
There was trouble. Yeah, it was instant red flag that we referred to a one-time only performance from like
79.
A concert like 30 years ago.
But, so, you know, in going in the room right there and playing down together, I mean, the good thing about the way The Roots work day to day for the Fallon show is they're not learning the music 2 seconds before performance. They're going in and working on the music for the show and their music, an environment where there's no escape from the music. It's a tiny, it's like the tech cupboard in most studios that's been converted into a workroom. So I go in there and there's literally, you know, we're standing shoulder to shoulder in the best possible sense and learning this song. What I didn't know is that everything is recorded in that room. It's running the whole time. What I now realize was a master plan or dastardly scheme. There were these little cells of music which are no less authentic the foundation of a song than me picking up the acoustic guitar and saying, here's the chords, this is how it goes, let's make it, you know.
So clearly you guys are in sync musically, but did you have like a master plan, a mission statement when you came into this?
The way we did it there was we started playing without any fear, any prior consultation, and we didn't really make any prior plans between ourselves. We just started playing and reacting to what we heard, and if it was good, it stayed on. If it wasn't, it got erased. Will you walk us uptown?
This first song on the new album, Walk Us Uptown, you know, it's got kind of a rhythmic vibe that reminds me of some of your earlier work, Elvis. It's got kind of like almost like a reggae punch to it. And Questlove, did you have that in mind? Were you a fan of those early records?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny because when we started this record, I had initial fear. I really wanted to sort of suppress what I was known for. I didn't want it to be that groove heavy. But then, you know, I sort of realized, like, you know, a lot of his earlier work, I mean, half that stuff could have been breakbeats in hip-hop circles. You know what I mean?
Right.
Pretty much, I wanted to channel in the spirit of it. I didn't want this to be a footnote in his history. I wanted this to be as an important of a statement as Trust was, or as this year's Model, or, you know, any of his records. Walk Us Uptown wasn't my personal intention for starting off the record. Initially, I wanted to take a super risk and start the album off with a slow song. It's like one of the last songs that we cut. A song very deep and personal to him. A little too personal.
It's a song that's called The Puppet Has Cut His Strings, and it only appears on the
deluxe version.
On the deluxe version, and that's not just, if you're going to call it deluxe, it better be that. And Puppet was a beautiful piece that Amir and Ray Angry conceived, and I sat at home and wrote one draft of the lyrics, and I actually recorded the vocal sitting at my kitchen counter on my computer. And then Amir wouldn't let me re-record that vocal because it was very to the point. Why is your face drawn on so glum, old chum? That last piece of music just was moving to me. Then I couldn't do anything else that confront this one subject. That occurred to me while I was returning to England for the first time since my father passed. And it was like all of the chaos of the world as we were living through in that moment was, you know, contained also in the chaos of his mind in the last months. Something that many people experience looking at a loved one in the last stages of a dementia-related illness. Before I could stop myself, I'd written The Last Hours and Days, a description, a literal description. Time is meaningless. We carry you on buckles. Through mournful airs and martyrs' hymns. Then one blue and one more yellow. You try to not to be too selfish when you're working with people for the first time. You're not telling all your stories. So to write a song that was deeply personal seemed like a selfishness to me in this context. But it came out before I could stop it. And then Amir wanted to open the record with it.
But for me, I feel like an artist of your caliber, songs are very therapeutic. And, you know, I kind of expected you to use this open canvas as your playground. The puppet has cut his
strings. Is there any chance that I imagine the late night schedule makes things tough? That any chance that you guys would contour
Elvis
with us?
Elvis is the one that's busy. Ball in your court, bud. No. You know, the information's not going to leave my head ever. So, I mean, if ever there's time for us to do anything together, yeah, absolutely. I welcome it.
You know, it's been a great joy to do it, even though there's so many dark and kind of sometimes, you know, horrifying images in this record. It would be a pleasure.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
That's Amir Questlove Thompson and Elvis Costello. Their album together with The Roots is called Wise Up Ghost. She's pulling out the pin. Dad let her head fall down. She's pulling out the pin. For the week ending September 22nd, 2013, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, and Jody Becker. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on Saturday and Sunday. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening. She's slipping off the hood. I'm buttoning her dress. She's slipping off the hood.